Authority Issues, a podcast about leadership, management, and having a love-hate relationship with the burgeoning local beer population. I'm Rachel Perkins, aka Pie or Pie Bob. I'm into words, operations, cheese, and whiskey, and of course, leadership.
And I'm Kendall Miller, the hottest new neural network brought to you by the people behind such hits as the Keebler Elves, John Lennon and Yoko Ono, and the Lord of the Springs fan fiction series.
Okay. All right, Kendall. Today on the show, we're talking with Sonia Matthews, formerly VP of Market Research and Competitive Intelligence at USAA, and currently board president at the Northwest School of Wooden Boat Building. Hi, it is really good to have you on the show.
Yes.
Hi, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
And Sonia, before we even get started, sorry, Rachel, I am a longtime USAA member, and now that I have tried other banks, I really dislike everything else that I tell. USAA does a really forking fantastic job, and I assume it's because you are out there doing market research and competitive intelligence, and I don't want to shit on my business bank, Navy Federal, but holy fucking shit. If USAA could offer a business account, I would be really happy about that. Sorry. Okay, let's get started.
Wow, we are not sponsored by USAA, and also Sonia doesn't work there anymore. But we're going to have declarations. I'm going to declare. I'm a good friend of Sonia's. We live together in the same small town. I'm really psyched to talk to her today on the show because she's had an incredible path to leadership and has achieved a lot of cool stuff. So, you know, hold on to your butts, as they say. Anyway, I am going to start with the first question now. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Well, as you may know, we do ask the same question at the beginning of every episode of this podcast where we have a guest. We want to know where did you come from? How did you get to where you are now? Tell us about your path to leadership and start anywhere you like. Stunned.
Okay. Well, really, I mean, I meet USAA fans everywhere, and it's actually one of the reasons I was happy to have that be my last corporate gig before going into 501c3, working really hard but not getting paid for it land. So I too was a big fan, and the reason the organization did so well, although I left in 2016, so who knows now, Kendall, you may have to rethink that, but is because they put the consumer and the member at the center of everything they did, which is really, really cool. And it's fun to be in a leadership position in an organization like that because you know what your true north is. But how I got here to 2 hours west of the Seattle is actually a long journey, but it actually started out when I was a kid in North Carolina and was raised in the outskirts of Raleigh and had something really neat happen to me when I was 9, in that I became a farm kid. And it was a poser farm. My stepfather worked for IBM. He was the head of innovation for RTP for IBM, but he always wanted to embrace his inner farmer. So we had a few acres out in Apex, North Carolina, and wow. I got to drive a tractor. So I went from a latchkey kid, only child of a single parent, to a stepkid who lived in the farm, who got to drive the tractor. And it was this transmogrification from, you know, city life and being inside the four walls of the apartment to the wonderful world of nature and being able to drive a large machine. And that really fed my thirst.
It's real obvious how we get from here to VP of Marketing at USAA, and I'm excited to see if the details
back,
that I expect.
No,
this is wonderful. I'm actually really enjoying this. Keep going.
Okay. All right. Good. All right. So you're like the you're like the comic disruptor, are you?
It's usually Rachel's job, but they're usually my guests. So now that since you came by way of Rachel, I have to be the Anyways, keep going.
So I went from latchkey kid to tractor driver, and I don't know, there's something about being 8 and being on the tractor and being able to drive that just gives you this sense of power and of delight.
Oh, here we go.
the thirst for adventure and a healthy respect for not getting your foot caught in the wheel. So after that, you know, I basically started to, well, really just drink in the world and try to learn as much as I possibly could. Not doing very well, to be candid, in school. I was kind of a B-minus student on a good day, but got into a decent college, graduated with a degree in business with a minor in statistics, because I like my decisions to be smart, and statistics is a great way of determining chance or skill, you know, dependent.
Well, I want to interrupt you now.
Yes,
I have a question. I have a question. So, yes. A, where did you go to school?
I went to school at Queen's University. Queen's University in Charlotte, North Carolina.
In Charlotte. And why did you decide to study what you studied? I mean, you in retrospect, you're like, I like to have information. And this is one of the reasons we're friends. We like to have a lot of context for our making decisions. And I think we think a lot like that, But how did you decide that when you were, you know, a mere teen getting into college? Like what made you, did you go for a while and then choose?
No, I think I started school. Actually, yes, you're right. Thank you for asking me that question. I started out with a desire to practice law. And so I enrolled thinking that I would go into pre-law. And then the school did me a really awesome favor. And during January term, my sophomore year, I got to do an internship with the Charlotte-Mecklenburg County District Attorney's Office. And I found out, much to my surprise, that if I were to become a defense attorney, most of my clients would be guilty. And it's not something that had really occurred to me before. And I don't think that you should be judged by your worst act. But I also didn't think that I would have the stamina or appetite or really the ability to do a really good job by these individuals. And so I flipped to business. And
I thought you were going to say you interacted with all these lawyers and decided lies and damned lies weren't enough. So you went for statistics.
Okay, yeah. So Kendall, thank you for messing up my joke, because that was later, right after I told you about the four kinds of statistical data.
You cut her off.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call USAA and have them cancel your insurance right now. No, I'm kidding. Don't do that. You know, I would never give up my USAA insurance. Yeah, yeah, we do. and I would never change. But anyway, so going back to pre-law, decided, no, not so great, would go into business. But I really loved, I almost changed my major my senior year to chemistry, because that was really, really cool. So anyway, liked statistics because I just liked it. I had a really good teacher, and I wanted to be more confident about my business decisions. And I liked the four different kinds of data, of which now there's a fifth. And maybe if you do a podcast on extreme nerds, I could come on and talk to you about the fifth kind of data that's just come up.
All our podcasts are about extreme nerds.
Yeah, that's true. Keep going. Keep going. We got a lot of life left, so we're making it difficult.
I'm going to try to hurry here. And then I got a job as a production manager with Washburn in Charlotte, because I graduated in, oh my God, a million years ago in 1985, when there was, well, people were having difficulty finding jobs. So I got a good job as a production manager, but I was horribly unsuited to be one. Basically, it's
What is Washburn? And,
yeah, Washburn is a Washburn Press was a really fine press organization in Charlotte, and Washburn Direct Marketing was affiliated with it, so it was really all about direct mail. Okay. So we did a lot of mailings for banks and law firms and other organizations. And the job required a lot of attention to detail and juggling a lot of projects, but they were not fun or exciting. And I am one of those people, I want to be interested in what I'm doing. I want to find it fun. And I want to drive a little bit more, because remember, tractor girl, drive a little bit more than I want to ride. So
that's where I ended up. That's good.
Yeah. I'll bring you there if you don't interrupt with the better joke. So.
Oh, we're going to interrupt.
That's not possible. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay. That's all right.
So keep going. So Washburn, and then what? How'd you end up in California? And what was the progression here?
So from Washburn, I went to Golden Corral Corporation, which is in Raleigh. I ended up moving back home for a few years. And in Golden Corral Corporation was actually a restaurant chain, but really it was in the business of selling franchises and restaurant equipment. It's important when you're joining an organization to find out what the true source of income is. And that was the biggest source of income for Golden Corral. And I had a few years working with them in my new career as a research analyst. So I put aside my production manager hat and I embraced my inner geek and decided that I would work with numbers and that I would try to separate correlation and causation, and really got into the business of trying to convince companies that they needed to make a certain decision based on data and a better definition of consumer need and what was effective. And that's where it hooked me. So basically, in having conversations with CEOs, CMOs, all the O's, trying to figure out what to do moving forward in order to serve the end consumer better and make smarter decisions, I was that messenger. And I really liked doing that. I liked helping guide organizations towards better decisions. So after right, that, it that was point, a question of, yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm interrupting once again. At that point, had you had any direct reports, any staff, or was this an individual contributor role that you had been working with?
It was right then that I eventually got my first employee, and I was probably the world's worst boss to that person, but I learned, hopefully got better. But yeah, I went from Golden Corral to Metro Media. Metro Media was owned by John Kluge, which is a very famous German first generation immigrant to U.S., owned a lot of organizations, including Metro Media Restaurant Group, and I was the VP of Research and Analysis for them for about 9 years, and stood up a lot of the first ever ways of measuring performance from an employee and a consumer perspective for each of the restaurants, and used it to drive innovation and also help to teach managers and promote the managers that needed to be promoted and help train managers that needed to be trained. So that's when I started to quote unquote lead people, although I've always tried to be a good leader, a thought leader, and then also a good follower as well. I think both are important.
Okay, yeah, and so you said you were at the beginning. Oh, go ahead, Kendall. I've asked a bunch of questions.
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of questions here. So, yeah, you go from this first leadership role, and then is your next one a VP role?
I started as a director and then became senior director and then vice president. Okay. But, you know, it was pretty quickly in succession. It was a small organization. I mean, we were an international group, but it was relatively small. And I worked really hard and focused. I did not have children. I didn't even have a pet. You know, I was basically at the office all the time. And I was also very lucky.
Yeah, well, so tell the story of that, the first time you're a leader and had an employee and you're pretty sure you were a terrible leader and then you improved. I mean, was there training along the way? Did you just learn everything the hard way? Like what happened along the...
So I think I went to the Stephen Covey Leadership Week, I think, right after I became a VEEP and started getting more directs. And it was an interesting retreat. It was almost all male. I think I was one of two women in the retreat. There were probably 30 of us there. It was for a week. And we were learning the 7 habits of highly effective leaders, etc. And I remember we broke out into teams, and the person facilitating the class saw that the two women were together in a group and said, "Oh, no, no, we don't want you together. We need to separate you." Not realizing that there were 5
safety
5 pods of all males all together, you know, and I just thought, oh, hostile, you know, weird. I have so many words for that. But we just kind of looked at each other and laughed and then went off into our other groups. But anyway, I was trained a little bit. But at the time, I distinctly remember equating being a manager over somebody with having control over them. And that is just not the way I think now. I think about it now and I cringe. But, you know, I thought that meant that basically you were responsible for everything that person did. And that is not true.
Well, what made you change your thinking on that? Like, just years of doing it? Or, I mean, was there something along the way where you were like, hang on a second, I'm a little bit more effective if I don't lead this way? Or what happened?
Two things. One is my realm of responsibility expanded to the point where I couldn't have that. And the other is in conversations with employees, understanding they weren't very happy. So, you know, and in having received that kind of treatment myself, realizing, well, if I don't like it, I'm sure this person doesn't like it either. So I began to basically start watching other managers' interactions, had better conversations with employees, got to travel to different organizations, because sometimes how you're interacting with your employee might be partly culture in addition to your proclivities. And so just really taking that curiosity that I had about the animal world and about science and all of those things, and really putting it towards, you know, okay, my desire is to be effective and to add value. And how can I be effective and add value when I'm managing others? And so took that passion and pointed it in that direction. So I think I got better.
And are you grateful? Sounds like you had at least one employee come to you or you had a conversation with that employee and they were like, this isn't working for me. Like, did someone literally come to you and say that, or was it a more general realization?
No, I think it was more general. I do think that I had other people who watched me with others give me counsel, and for that I am very grateful.
Oh, that's great.
You know,
yeah.
Sometimes you learn when you see how others are interacting and you have a visceral response that is negative, you're like, oh, what if I did that? Oh no, I think I did. And then you just have that horrible realization. But instead of letting the shame of it break you down, you use it to strengthen your resolve to do better. And there's also a mea culpa conversation that needs to happen. You know, hey, as I was thinking the other day about this interaction, I realized that I did not ask you how you felt about this. I didn't ask for your input. You are the expert in this situation, and I should have led with that. I am sorry, and mean it. Not an empty apology and go back and do it again, but just recognition, because no human is perfect. Well, except for Kendall, we know that. But no human is perfect.
What episode is this going to be? 99? Did we finally fucking get there? Thank you, Sonia.
You know, I mean, you're welcome. You owe me $20.
It took us a while.
Yeah. But nobody is perfect, and for us to pretend that that's true is just silly.
That's true. Yeah. It's true. Yeah. I agree.
So now I'm curious, I mean, with that hindsight, I have so many questions, and I want to get into the nonprofit side and that too,
yes,
and how leadership's different there. But I, like, with this hindsight of what you've learned along the way, if you could go back to young Sonia and say, you know, here's, save you a whole bunch of trouble, just this, or this, or just don't X, Y, Z. I mean, do you have a few quippy thoughts that you wish you could pass on to younger you?
Not very many, because I will say that what I know now is a result of the abject failures and successes in my life. And candidly, I learned more from when I messed up than when I was successful. But I will actually quote one of my favorite humans, who is, you will be glad to know, a former president of USAA. His name is General Robles. And he said that God gave you one mouth and two ears. Use them accordingly. In other words, listening more than I spoke in certain key situations, I think could have helped me out. So sometimes you think
that's the case for absolutely everyone.
And yes, listening, not waiting to speak. There's a very big difference between those two. So I think, Kendall, it was a really good question. If I had been more mindful of those two things, I think I would have learned more faster.
Okay.
What, to that point, even as you're sharing that, and I've heard something similar before, and it's a good, like, it's true, it's a good quote, all of that, but my initial reaction is like, and I have one but, and I have one, like, what how do I use these in proportion to? Yes. Like, I'm immediately, my head does not stop and listen and take it in.
You are 14. I know.
Anyways, I am 14. So, then, tell us about how you... I'm older than 14, let the record show, but in maturity, in no way. Talk about the end of that career cycle, up through USAA, and then why did you make the change to 501c3
well,
land?
I want to hear about what happened next and the kind of work that Sonia did after she got her first VP role. So what happened after that?
Metro Media was starting to, it was a chain, and it was right before the rise of the great independent restaurants. And I felt like I had done what I needed to do in the organization, and I wanted a challenge. And so I flipped over to the Frito-Lay PepsiCo world. So I went from a small, privately held international organization, but smaller, to this giant, publicly owned organization that had 15 billion dollar brands at the time. I was there from 2003 to 2010. And it was a very different culture. It was rampant Darwinism, where people didn't knife you in the back. They'd show you the knife and say, get out of my way. But it was actually, it sounds really scary, but it was actually kind of cool. So I know Rachel's making a face. I mean, if you want to be challenged when you come to work, it was a little bit like the movie Gladiator. It really was. I mean, there was a gauntlet that you had to get through, but there were so many talented folk there, very intelligent, very fast moving, great brands, and a lot of cash that you could use to spend on things that you thought you needed to spend to make better business decisions for the organization. And I got to build a retail lab. So basically, the then CMO said, you know what, Sonia, we need a place for us to look at our items on the shelves so that we can better figure out how to get more market share. Because at the end of the day, it was all about shelf space and market share in all the different channels. Channels meaning, you know, big box, convenience store, drugstores, etc. Because we were not a direct-to-consumer. We had not figured out how to make the Pepsis fly through the air and into the refrigerators of the consumer. There needed to be a channel in the middle, much to our chagrin. So anyway,
grocery stores have to exist.
Exactly. And by the way, have you ever wondered, if you ever shop the soda aisle, all of the Pepsi products are shelved together. All of the Coke products are shelved together. The consumer doesn't think that way. The consumer thinks, I want a Sprite and I want a Mountain Dew. And by the way, they're kind of the same color-ish. And maybe they should be close together. No, they are shelved within the parent company, which makes no sense. It's not consumer-based. It's supplier-based. But hopefully my PepsiCo buddies won't call me about that one. But anyway, so I took an old grocery store, and I had cash from Frito-Lay, and built a 20,000 square foot retail theater that we could use for experiments and displays. And it was actually built on this IKEA-like grid so that we could hang different lighting and walls on it. And I had at one point 8 different experiments going on in that one venue at the same time. It was just an uber geek's dream. But anyway, and we used that to help us understand our brands and how they interacted with the shopper and other brands, because as much as we hated to admit it, there were other brands besides the PepsiCo portfolio.
What? I know.
Quel dommage, yes. And so we used it to just better understand them too. It was a lot of fun, and I can't think of another organization that would have given me the support to do that. And build your own grocery store.
That's amazing.
Well, actually, it was a retail theater. It was a retail theater, so we could use to recreate areas of Walmart, Target, drug stores, convenience stores, vending. So it was basically a theater. You could rearrange things and move them around to create the different environments.
And so it was helpful with the suspension of disbelief.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like you bring in a group of people and be like, okay, you're shopping at X. What do you do? Like you just watch them. Oh, something's happening.
The dogs are having to. Yeah, no. So we looked at transactional, attitudinal, and behavioral information. And so, yeah, they were on camera. They were moving around the store. We questioned them afterwards. We asked them to make choices, et cetera. We tried to create as natural an experience as possible so that they would act more normally. And then, of course, later on, we got to what I would call the gentle stalking phase, which is that we worked in partnership with the retail establishments so that we could access their camera data to better understand how people are moving through the store. And I was able to use this information to help determine how much a trip mission meant to the amount of money that you spent and where you shopped in the store, and also to help inform what I call the epigenetics of retail. So how you change the environment in the retail and the impact that it has on your perception of maybe other areas of the store. But anyway,
yeah, like the colors and the lighting and all that stuff. It's super cool. And you probably had a fairly large staff of researchers, right? People who set up these experiments and helped you and presented the data to you. Or did you do most of the analysis yourself?
No, I didn't do most of the analysis myself. I did have a team of analyst types, manager types too. And also we had a lot of research company partners that we would hire that would conduct the research. This would allow us to move much faster because if I'm working with the top 10 channels or customers of PepsiCo, they're all very busy, very big organizations. If I needed to do all that work myself or my directs, it would take too much time. So we were able to reach scalability and speed by hiring outside folks. And we were fortunate.
What do you think the biggest challenge you had in terms of, you built out this team, you had money to build out this facility. Did you have any difficulty presenting its research to your leadership? Was there any management difficulty around that time? Like, what was your biggest challenge there?
The biggest challenge that a researcher has, I think, is and this has been the same throughout my career, so it isn't specific to PepsiCo. Is that often when you are delivering results, there is a tendency to believe the good or the news that makes you comfortable and disbelieve the news that makes you uncomfortable, even though the methods and the people are the
shocking.
Same. Yeah. Yeah. And it can be a crushing blow, especially to an analyst who has pulled an all-nighter to get this information, feels like he or she is doing right by the company by presenting the emperor has no clothes data, right, in a way that is respectful and true, only to be shot down. Whereas the previous week they were the fan of the organizations because they supported a decision that had been made. So I guess it's important to not take those things personally and to persevere with courage despite the potential response of the high-powered executive receiving the information.
So it sounds like you had that experience a number of times. Was it you personally, or were you like supporting folks who were delivering these results and like, they hate me. And then you're like, it's fine. Don't worry.
It was me personally, or it was worse, my team who might be interacting with somebody and receiving, feedback of, no, this person doesn't know what they're talking about. And that might be true, but you violently agreed with the same kind of study the week before. And, you know, pointing out that does not help. So telling the executive, well, last week you really liked us, so what's the difference? That isn't helpful. And I've tried that, and no, it's not good. But perhaps the thing that I did learn, and this was the ears and mouth situation, Kendall, is it was really important to have a meeting with this person before the big present out. And
the pre-meeting.
Ask questions. Yeah. It's the meeting before the meeting, which takes time, but guess what? It's the right thing to do. And guess what? You might have overlooked something. You might have to go back and say, mea culpa, you know what? I designed this thing the wrong way. We really need to get at this other issue. So, having the meeting before the meeting, working in partnership, perhaps having the business unit lead present the data with, in other words, have the insight and then the follow-up action together. This is like the gold, right? Well, we found out that usability, for instance, for the insurance funnel had leaks. So people were going from awareness to conversion or awareness to acquisition, but there were a lot of people falling off at this one stage. So we identified it through usability research, brought it to the person who ran that particular insurance division, auto, and then had that person come to the present out to the president of auto and the CEO of the organization in tandem and say, okay, we've identified this hole in the funnel and Rick will be moving forward with this solution.
Like, and you've already gone to them and that you're not like catching them unawares. It's a, you know, this is all big happy family kind of situation. Yeah. The psychology of that is obviously great, right?
It takes a leader and who's receiving that information. It takes somebody who's willing to go there with you. But when that happens, it is incredibly energizing to everyone because the leader and that leader's people, they're seeing this collaboration at work and it's infectious, right? When you
it's a good feeling,
collaboration,
yeah,
you espouse more a collaboration and it's all good.
So how, like, market research and competitive intelligence sounds, what was your title at the Pepsi company? Was it something similar?
Yeah, it was, customer strategy and market insights or something like that. It's been a while.
Yeah, VP of customer strategy and insights.
Well, so then when you're at USAA, I mean, there's a couple different parts of USAA and I don't know if there's things in between. We got to keep going because I've got a few other questions too, but
Well,
once you're working at USAA, it's like a tech company. It's not a tech company. It's a bank. It's an insurance company. It's, you know, all these different things. It feels like the way that you're talking about things are what I would think of in a SaaS company as a like VP of product, right? Like it's the person who's talking to the customers all the time, asking what they want, seeing how they use it, responding to, okay, we need to come back internally and adjust this way or that way. Are those two different, you know, like at USAA, was there a VP of product as well that you worked hand in hand with that then went and implemented that, whereas you were just finding out, or like, what was the, how is that different, I guess, is a little bit
of
what I'm getting at.
Great. So at USAA, I had 150 research analysts working throughout the organization. And we had, there was insurance, there was life, there was insurance, there was investments, and then there was banking. So a lot of companies within a company. And then each one of those companies had different product leads. So VPs who were in charge of the specific products. And then we also had MX, which was basically the, you know, about the interstitium. Have you guys done any work on that? So it's basically what connects the fascia muscles that connect across the organization. Because we were, and I think you inferred this, Kendall, we were a bank without a branch. We are a life insurance company and insurance company without branches themselves. Everything is in the digital space. And these MX people would run the call centers, which is really the interaction between the company and the consumer. So that level of interaction, those interpreters. So there was NMAX as well. And our research analysts work with, you know, nominal, ordinal, interval, and ratio data. And they, you know, did voice of the member data or text analytics. They would do qual and usability. They would do quant, et cetera. And it was really great because whereas at PepsiCo, a lot of the analysts' work were done by third-party valued research partners who ran their own companies, all of our work at USAA was done internally. And that was a blessing and a curse. It was a blessing because they knew our business really well. It was a curse because they are also, you know, very familiar with each of the players and so didn't have that consultant distance, right? Mm-hmm. They were very, very close to the people who were making the business decisions.
And it could be hard to hear when change needs to happen when it's internal.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And they That's a classic thing about consultants is like, you know, you've had someone internally telling you you need to do a thing, and but no, you really, you need to pay like $10 million and get someone come in and tell you exactly what you heard before.
Please pay me. Pay me. I will come. I have a $5 million package. You tell me what to say. I just deliver it to the executives. I don't even have to do any work. I will just say it. We've got some standard questions too that we always ask, but I still want to get at real quick. Talk about the transition to nonprofit. Why'd you make the transition? What's different about leadership in a nonprofit organization? And it sounds like you're on the board now. And a board seat's a little different too. It's probably a different kind of like reports, but talk about that change.
Yeah, I'm on two boards now, but I have been on the Boat School board for about 7 years and love it. In 2011, a year after I joined USAA, I had got stage 3 breast cancer. And so I had 2 large masses, and it was pretty scary. I didn't know whether or not I would be around. And so I had surgery and radiation and chemo and a lot of wonderful support from USAA and the community and my family, and made it through and have been cancer-free for 13 years now. So but after getting through that, I don't know, you tried to go back to work, didn't you? I tried. I did. I worked through the whole thing. I'm insane, you know. I didn't want to stay home and think, you know, am I going to survive this? What am I going to do? You know, I feel really nauseated, etc. No, I wanted to go to work, and had a lot of great support from the organization in doing so. But after I got through it, and I would go to work every day, and I would get there around 7, and I would leave around 7, you know, and work on the weekends. And it was still amazing work and very gratifying, and my team was awesome. But it just didn't feel the same. I didn't look forward to it every day anymore. And I thought, you know, I think what I might be telling myself is that I'm ready for another change. Kind of like I talked about at Metromedia. I was like, you know, been there, done that. Well, I think I'd been there, done that as far as corporate work. And I was ready to do a different kind of work. And so my husband and I sold the house. And we actually did a spreadsheet of where we would like to live, and we had weighted variables, and we picked the top 2, and then we went for our gut with our gut for the top one, and then we moved, like I said, to the Olympic Peninsula. And right after then, I just thought, you know, I'm a little bored. So speaking of boards, I joined the Northwest School of Wood and Boat Building as their board president, and it's been an amazing transition from corporate person to nonprofit 501c3 governance and support advisor. And basically, I'm a volunteer who pays the school every year for the pleasure of working with them, right? As a board member. And I get to work with a really talented executive director and team. And I get to, on the board as board president, really make sure that each board member is given the opportunity to guide, govern, and support in the way that they were brought on the board to do, without fear of reprisal and or editing or censorship. You know, as board president, I'm really there to make sure that everybody has input and to help really guide that input into the school to help guide its strategy. And a 501c3 executive directors are all kinds of talented. They're all entrepreneurial, high energy, usually underpaid, never underappreciated, and just wonderful humans to watch. I've been so inspired by the EDs that I've had the pleasure of working with since I retired in 2016.
Yeah, and okay. You and I have talked about this kind of thing, you know, because we've had some related experiences on boards, although your executive experience is significantly greater than mine, but that it's almost more political in terms of dealing with individual personalities, and that your experience with the psychology of presenting information and how and when to do the pre-meeting and when to follow up, and it all of that stuff is even more valuable in these situations where you need to guide decision making. You can't let things get mired down in what might be considered public opinion, that kind of stuff. It's super interesting, and I think that, you know, the background that you've had must have really made a difference there. Do you have any comments on that? Any experiences you want to share?
I think one of the things that struck me when I first came was the fact that most nonprofits do not have nearly enough resources that they need in mm-hmm. order to get things done. But many of them have an incredibly inspiring cause. Like, for instance, at the boat school, really teaching the individuals who are coming in with a complete lack of experience in many cases, how to be good craftspeople. I was just talking to one today. Her name is Pearl. She's a Prothero intern for the boat school. She started out when she entered the boat school a few years ago. She was a bartender. And she went from bartender to first-class boat builder in 1 year because of the efforts of this school. And it is such a great delight in being able to see the transformation of this human who is making cocktails and then, again, creating boats out of wood, taking something that's round, turning it something that's flat, and then curving it, and then building a boat out of it. I mean, that's hard. Yeah.
So, it's magic.
I would say that the magic of nonprofits, it slowed me down. It helped me to focus again on what the end result is and work on shoring up the energy and resolve of the executive director, almost as a counselor and advisor. So I wanted to just be supportive to her and not yeah. make it about me at all, but make it about how can I help her do what she needs to do? How can I suit her up? So instead of me suiting myself up in the morning or suiting my employees or my boss up, it's really supporting her. And I'm not really saying that very well, but I think having a powerful mission mm-hmm. has been incredibly energizing, and it's helped spark my interest in working again.
That's really awesome.
And I was in nonprofit world for 10 years, and I think the power of the individual stories that you hang on to from the change that you were able to create really hangs in there in a different way than for-profit, because my frustration with nonprofit is that the goals are always just way harder to measure. Like, are we doing this? Are we not? Like, did we teach the people to build the boats? Well, I've got a couple stories, but like, are we, you know, or whatever. I don't know what the mission is exactly. But like, on the one hand, I find it a lot harder to measure than, frankly, did the number go up in the dollar amount, right? And I'm not saying that's better. I'm just saying I do find the cleanliness of the measurability of that to be refreshing sometimes in for-profit world. You end up with some different politics when it's like, but I'm here because I fucking care about the mission. And it's like, yeah, but you're shit at your job. So like, it'd be nice if you left and, you know, whatever. Like, it just it gets way more complicated, but
yeah, measuring anyways. Or managing volunteers, we there's a lot about that, and I wish we had actually gotten to that sooner, because we haven't got a ton of time left, but I definitely know that your relationship to authority changed some of the things that you've told us about throughout your career. In fact, early on in your career, you realize, oh no, I'm not just the boss of this person and get to tell them what to do at all times and monitor every single thing that they do and have no faith in their ability, et cetera. I'm putting words in your mouth here, but it sounds like I definitely went through that turmoil, like, no, it's all my fault. And also I am in charge of everything. It's just not how that works. What do you feel like your relationship with authority is now? How do you feel like, you know, how do you feel about having authority over other people, and how do you feel about others having authority over you? Does anybody have authority over you now, or are you just the big boss of everything?
I don't know the answer to that one. I'm going to start with the other one and hope it comes to me.
Get there.
So managing volunteers or interacting with volunteers is so different. You know, we can mm-hmm. always just walk away. And actually, you know what? So can employees. Employees can do that too. And that's actually my biggest aha, is that in working with volunteers now, I make sure that it hits on that they're able to do something that has meaning to them, that they're good at, and that the organization needs. That has to be that trifecta. If it doesn't hit on all three, it's not going to work. It's not going to stick. But being really careful to make sure that that volunteer is having a joyful or at least a satisfying experience is key. And guess what? That should be the exact same way that employees are treated. Just because we pay them doesn't mean that they should not be joyful, that they should not have satisfaction on what they're doing, and that they shouldn't be allowed to do what they're good at. That's the key.
It's just harder to deliver.
Different. It is harder. And Kendall's right that there's a lack of metrics that is terrifying for me, being a geek. A metrics person, it was a little scary to ask for the data and being given a bunch of anecdotal stuff. I will tell you that is a big bummer. But the fact that we should treat all of our employees like volunteers, or at least this is what I think, was a big aha for me in my dotage.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know. There's so many more things that we want to ask, but we should pivot for time's sake. This has been really interesting, Sonia. Really appreciate you coming on and sharing with us. Tell us about life outside of work. It sounds like you're mostly retired. There's boats, but you can't talk about boats because now they're a part of work. So, like, what do you do when you're not doing that?
Well, I still like to read, and I like to walk in the park with my dogs. And like to go to the beach. I do like boats, but won't talk about that. But right now, I over volunteered. I did something in an area that has 140 nonprofits in about 10 square miles. And so I kind of did it to myself. I'm currently working like I was full time, but I'm going to get out of it soon. Rachel's going to help
Good.
Me with that. But I love to read, and I like to travel. And so hopefully we'll have time to do more of that very soon.
Heck, where do you want to go? Where's in the back of your head for a destination you want to hit?
Well, for my 20th anniversary, we're going to the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska to do a couple of weeks hiking there. And I am beyond excited about that. But really, the Olympic Peninsula is beautiful, and having lived in Texas and the East Coast for many years, there's tons of places we haven't explored yet. So really, we just want to get in the car, drive in, and tromp around the mountains of this beautiful country that we're in.
Is it the Olympic Peninsula all the time, or only during the summer and winter festivals of the Olympics?
I don't think
not everybody necessarily knows where the Olympic Peninsula is, so...
That's okay. That's what Google is for, right? It became a verb. That's how we knew it was okay. You know, the Cascades are north of Seattle, and I would say that's more seasonal. You really need chains to drive around the Cascades, half the year at least. The Olympics, we have a temperate climate. It's kind of like Mediterranean-ish. And so you can drive around all year. You just will be damp. So
damp all year.
But the Olympics are beautiful. I highly recommend them. people should come visit.
Well, so we need to wrap up there. Rachel, you want to ask your last question?
Well, I'm going to go ahead and let y'all know that I will put Sonia's LinkedIn link on the show notes so that you can get in touch with her if you want to talk to her about what it's like to over-volunteer, because, oh my gosh. I wanted to ask you one more thing. Has becoming, like, have you changed the way that you interact with the people in your personal life based on things that you've learned as you've become a leader? Thoughtful look.
Gosh, you know, and pauses are not good on podcasts because, you know, you can't see the head tilt. I don't
especially know. Especially when I leave
them in. I don't know.
I will say that I am more appreciative of my friends now that I have supposedly more free time to interact with them. And I have learned that through nonprofit service, I have been able to meet so many people who are altruistic and really care about their community. And I find my interactions with them to be very joyful. So it might be that I'm meeting a different kind of person, or maybe I'm just in a more receptive frame of mind. I'm not really sure what it is, but I am enjoying spending time with my friends very much.
Awesome. Cool. Well, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show. And I look forward to sharing it with you when we publish it.